Monday, November 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Texas officials look for a motive in the deadly shooting at a church in Sutherland Springs. Japan's prime minister says all options are on the table regarding North Korea's nuclear program, and the one-year anniversary of President Donald Trump's election approaches this week. It's all ahead. Texas authorities tried Monday to figure out what motivated 26-year-old Devin Kelly, a dishonorably discharged U.S. airman, to open fire on a Baptist church, killing 26 people and wounding 20 more. On Sunday, Kelly fired on churchgoers with a weapon similar to an AR-15 assault rifle. Witnesses say Kelly first fired on people outside the small First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Then inside were all but two of the victims were killed or wounded. The victims were between the ages of 18 months and 77 years old. Freeman Martin is with the Texas Department of Public Safety.
We can tell you that there was a domestic situation going on within this family. The suspect's mother-in-law attended this church. We know that he had made threatening texts from him, and we can't go into details about that domestic situation that is continuing to be vetted and thoroughly investigated. But we want to get that out there that this was not racially motivated. It wasn't over religious beliefs. There was a domestic situation going on within the family and the in-laws.
VOA's Giselle Tobias is on the scene in Sutherland Springs. He described to me how the shooting began.
He began attacking the church about 11:20, and after he was seen at a Valero gas station, which is right in front of this church in Sutherland Springs. He was all dressed all black, according to the Department of Public Safety police. Then after that, the suspect crossed the street to the church and finally started firing at the church. Finally, he fled in a car who crashed, and the police was able to find it. But the shooter was killed when the police finally found him. We don't know yet if he killed himself or he was hit by a gunshot, because some neighbors were following him. They were chasing him. So the police doesn't still know, or they haven't confirmed, if this guy killed himself or he died because the neighbors finally hit him after the persecution. This shooter was identified as Devin Kelly, 26 years old, who was from New Braunfels here in Texas. We know too that he used to be at the Air Force, but from 2010 when he was discharged, and that's information that we already confirmed.
Is it known why he targeted this particular church?
That's exactly the question everybody is doing around here. They haven't said that yet. We don't know for sure why he specifically targeted this church, but it has to be a reason, according to the police and some other neighbors around here, since this is a very rural place. This is a place that is like 45 minutes away from San Antonio. It's a very old town with just about 500, 700 people living here. It's a very small town. So to come here specifically to this church, you have to have definitely a point. You have to have something to come to do here, and that's why the neighbors are saying right now.
Well, the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, says this is the worst mass shooting in Texas history. The people who live there must just be devastated.
Yes, especially because this is a very small town. Looks like everybody knows someone who was killed in this church. I have to mention the 8 people that were killed during the shooting belong to the same family. So that means we're talking about a very small town who is really impacted by this, something like this, how the worst shooting massacre happened in this small town. That's the question they're having right now.
VOA's Giselle DeBias reporting from Sutherland Springs, Texas. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure there's a lot of reaction on social media to this.
There is. People are using hashtag Texas Church Massacre, other hashtags to talk about this incident. And as we often see after these mass shootings, social media kind of devolves into this anger and frustration where you have people lashing out at each other with no other way to really express their sadness, the helplessness, the rage at this horrible event. So you see a lot of unfortunate instances where people are sending each other nasty messages and nasty posts on social media just because of that anger and the sadness that consumes the situation. You see a lot of people trying to determine the shooter's political leanings and motivations based on the alleged social media posts that he's put out. Some of that information has been cleared up by investigators who just within the past hour or so said that this was, they believe, a domestic dispute, that the shooter's in-laws and ex-wife attended this church, although they were not present there yesterday, and numerous posts where people are calling for gun control. Now, this is an interesting topic because people are pointing out a local man named Johnny Langendorf, who chased down and fired at the suspect with his shotgun, potentially wounding him. That's still being under investigation. Continuing this debate over whether more people should be armed and could prevent an attack like this if they were armed, or if people shouldn't have guns in the first place. And so this is the back and forth that we're seeing, kind of the policy debate as a result of this tragedy. Many others expressing the horror that out of the top five deadliest mass shootings in modern U.S. history, two have been within the past 5 weeks because, of course, October 1st was that deadly, the deadliest, in fact, U.S. shooting, 58 people killed in Las Vegas on October 1st. Now, adding to the debate over guns and the addressing guns, whether there needs to be more guns or fewer guns, President Trump is saying that the shooting wasn't an issue of guns, but an issue of mental health. That has a lot of people talking. Not lost on people that President Trump is in Japan right now on his Asia trip, a country that has strict gun laws and had less than 10 gun deaths on average for the past number of years. So people saying that there is a link there. Other people noting that earlier this year, President Trump replaced and repealed regulations that made it more difficult for people with mental illnesses to purchase firearms, so that there is a link there, even if he does say that this is a mental illness issue. But social media is also bringing people together to mourn, and we're seeing a lot of people, again, that phrase, thoughts and prayers, trying to mourn these victims. As Giselle just talked about, one family lost 8 people over 3 generations in that family. So there are a lot of these terrible stories that we're hearing and tragic instances from this that people are sharing on social media.
Yeah, it's just so, so sad. All right, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here's some of the top news stories trending. A Pakistani diplomat is killed in Afghanistan. The Paradise Papers reveal inner workings of elite tax havens. Amid an outcry, Afghan officials rescind a temporary ban on WhatsApp and Telegram. And the Turkish prime minister heads to Washington amid rising tensions. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Ancient legend has it that somewhere in this world, there is a magic fountain of youth whose waters contain restorative powers that make old people young again. Now, a new study from the University of Arizona says, sorry, folks, it's just not out there. Joanna Maisel, a professor at the university and one of the two study authors, says aging is unavoidable. Researchers found getting old is logically, theoretically, and mathematically inevitable. Maisel says current understanding of evolution does leave open a small chance that aging could be stopped. But to do so, she says science will need to come up with a way to make selection between organisms perfect. And at this time, that's something that just isn't that simple to do. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the first anniversary of President Trump's election to the White House approaches this week. We'll have a report. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, standing alongside U.S. President Donald Trump, said Monday that all options are on the table when it comes to responding to North Korea's weapons development. Following a second day of meetings, Abe and Trump confirmed that North Korea has been the dominant topic of their discussions. VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman is traveling with the president. He spoke to me from Tokyo about the meetings between the two leaders.
They had 2 days of meetings, some of them quite casual, over sandwiches at an exclusive country club, nine holes of golf, and then on Monday, more formal meetings, bilateral summit and a state dinner, and also this joint news conference today where they did say that North Korea was the primary topic, but trade was also on the agenda as well.
And what did they say about trade?
Well, unlike North Korea, where they say they're 100% in agreement on the approach towards Pyongyang, the two countries have their differences on trade, and that's nothing new. There has been this huge trade deficit that the United States has had with Japan for many decades. But Trump, as is characteristic, has been much more blunt in saying that this has got to be addressed, it's got to be fixed. And Abe was much more muted on the subject, but the president was optimistic, saying that the imbalance will be rectified. But there were no big trade announcements, and there's nothing on the horizon, such as a free trade agreement that would replace the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was that 12-country deal on free trade that the Obama administration had negotiated and Trump pulled out of very quickly when he became president.
President Trump also said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un should send back to Japan any surviving Japanese abducted by North Korean agents, and that took place over decades. This has been a very controversial topic between those two countries.
Yes, absolutely. This is a major issue in Japan and has been for many, many years, because you had dozens, perhaps more than 100 Japanese citizens over decades that were abducted, mostly in Japan, by agents of the North Korean government. Some of them died. The fate of others is unknown, and very few have come back. The president said, alongside Prime Minister Abe, it would be a tremendous signal, the start of something very special, if Kim Jong-un sent them back. And he said this shortly after meeting with family members of those who had been abducted, and he was obviously very touched by what they had to say.
Well, President Trump will arrive in South Korea on Tuesday. What are some of the main items on his agenda then?
Well, I think very similar to what we had in Japan, which is North Korea and trade. But I think there is much more nervousness among the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, and the South Korean people about how to approach North Korea. And also, President Trump has made no secret that he's been very unhappy with the Korea-U.S. trade agreement, again, something that was put together under a previous U.S. administration. The president said he's not happy with any of the trade agreements that the United States has and wants to either scrap them or redo them. So I think it's going to be perhaps a much stiffer meeting because of all of the ramifications for South Korea, not only with North Korea, but also on the trade issue. So that's what we're looking for. But the president will be speaking to the National Assembly, so he'll have an opportunity to lay out in some depth to the South Korean lawmakers exactly what he believes the approach should be towards North Korea.
VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Tokyo. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrested members of royalty, ministers, and investors, including multi-billionaire Al-Waleed bin Talal, in what is officially described as an anti-corruption crackdown. It's extended to the head of the National Guard. Some analysts view the latest move as a way for the Crown Prince to remove potential opposition to his reform agenda. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it underscores a struggle between conservatives who seek change by consensus and an impatient younger generation in the Saudi family.
Here's a situation where the Al-Saud family has been broken up in two parts. The old traditionalists, who believe in consensus, against the one that's basically saying that we are going to enforce rules, regulations and new policies without necessarily going through this process of consensus, which takes too much time and tends to dilute the intended policy purposes. Now that the decisions have been made with respect to the distribution of power away from the relatively old conservatives to the relatively young and ostensibly more liberal, a conflict has developed. And that conflict is being taken care of by taking arbitrary measures against those who do not agree with you.
What direction is Crown Prince Mohammed taking the country now, in your view?
Well, I think his intent was a good one. The implementation seems to have gone haywire for several reasons. One of those is quite clearly his inexperience and his impatience. You can't bring about change very fast and very rapidly in a society like Saudi Arabia. You cannot simply tell them that whatever people have been doing for the last 30, 40 years is useless, that they have to change their ways of doing things. The best way to do it is to bring about orderly, gradual change. And that requires getting people into confidence, telling them that it's in their interest, insisting on proving that it's in the interest of their children, the younger generation, whose standard of living right now is poorer than that of their parents 20 years ago. So therefore, what is important and very critical to note here is that whatever you may do, whatever intentions good, which in many cases to begin with were reasonably okay and good intentions, if you wish to implement them, go carefully, go cautiously. You cannot take on the enmity of your own people because this will then tend to boomerang. And even if you were to come out successful at the end, you will be bruised, you'll have less resources in your hands, and you will have created permanent enemies in the system. And that's something very dangerous for the long run.
Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. This is VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. This Wednesday marks the one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's election as the 45th U.S. president. Trump's surprise election sent shockwaves across the country and around the world. But his first 9 months in office have often been chaotic. Trump has followed through on some of his election promises, but failed on others. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Election night, 1 year ago, Donald Trump stuns the world with a presidential victory few saw coming.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
At his inauguration, Trump made a pledge to the working class voters who largely fueled his victory.
Politicians prospered, but the jobs left and the factories closed. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Trump's election signified a seismic shift in U.S. politics, says strategist John Feary.
I think the Republican base voter is now a Trump voter, and they see any effort to stymie President Trump from the Republicans as a direct assault on them.
But Trump's presidency got off to a rocky start with a massive protest march and a dispute over the size of his inaugural crowd through spokesman Sean Spicer.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear.
The president scored an early success with the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court.
The stock market just hit an all-time record high.
And he gets high marks for his handling of the economy, a booming stock market, and military gains against Islamic State. But Trump and his Republican allies suffered a setback with the defeat of a health care bill in the Senate.
The ayes are 49, the nays are 51. The motion is not agreed to.
That left the president's agenda effectively stalled, says Alan Lichtman.
No ruling party with unified control of government has ever come up as empty as the Trump administration and the Republicans who control the Congress of the United States.
The president's Twitter habit provided plenty of distractions, as did some controversial remarks following violent protests in Charlottesville, Virginia.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
The turmoil and lack of success in Congress have kept Trump's poll ratings low, says Larry Sabato.
A large majority of Americans now believe that Donald Trump is doing a poor job as president. They disapprove of his job performance, and it's going down rather than up.
But Trump's election-style rallies and tweets have kept his base fired up and ensured loyalty among most Republicans in Congress, says Matthew Dalek.
Because he has this pretty tight hold on 35-38%, makes it very hard for the Republicans who control Congress to openly challenge him.
Yet recent criminal indictments and the Russia probe also threatened to cast a shadow over the White House, adding to the uncertainty of where Trump's presidency is headed, says Sabato.
So can he turn it around? Yes. Can he get reelected? Sure. Now, sometimes the hard part's getting elected the first time. But he's making it difficult on himself, both for passing his agenda and for keeping the Congress in Republican hands and for getting reelected.
Trump's election was a defining moment in U.S. politics, but its impact on the country and the world remains an open question. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S.-led global coalition has achieved great successes against ISIS on the battlefield in Syria and Iraq. We celebrate the coalition's gains on the ground, but, notes U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales, we also have to be mindful that ISIS is adapting, and it's going to be up to us to adapt along with them.
Every square kilometer of territory that's liberated means women and children and men who no longer have to live under the oppressive false caliphate that ISIS has tried to construct. The success that we're having, though, against ISIS in Syria and Iraq doesn't mean that the struggle is over. It simply means that the struggle is entering a new stage. And that new stage is one in which ISIS might be sending operatives across the world to carry out attacks. Another related problem is people who may be inspired by ISIS to commit attacks.
Homegrown terrorism is a threat that is on the rise, and it is one that we are going to be focusing on, he said. The United States and its Global Counterterrorism Forum partners recently announced new initiatives to address threats posed by returning foreign terrorist fighters and by homegrown terrorists. Two separate programs seek to effectively assess the motivations and sympathies of returning family members and to explore the factors that drive people to become homegrown terrorists and identify them before they can strike. The United States and the Global Counterterrorism Forum also endorsed new recommended strategies to counter radicalism online.
Well, ISIS spreads a message of hatred, a perversion of the tenets of Islam. It's essential for us, and it's essential for our partners around the world, to counter that message of hate and intolerance and violence. So we have to work with not just other governments, but civil society organizations, religious leaders, community organizers, and private citizens who are in a position to effectively rebut these false claims.
The U.S. will continue to adapt and work together with its partners within both government and communities to realize a world that is secure against terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.